Les conférences du Collège de France.
Je suis très heureux de pouvoir vous présenter le grand poète anglais Geoffrey Hill. Sa présence parmi nous au Collège est un grand moment pour le Collège. Il va faire une lecture commentée de ses poèmes en anglais. Si vous voulez lire ses poèmes en traduction française, il existe 4 recueils bilingues. Je vous donnerai les titres maintenant. Si vous n'arrivez pas à les saisir au passage, vous pouvez toujours me demander les détails après. Il y a d'abord « Hymne de merci » dans la traduction de Jacques d'Arras, publié par Les Trois Cailloux. Le château de Pentecôte et autres poèmes, traduits par René Gallet, Obsidiane. Scène avec Arlequin et autres poèmes, traduction également de René Gallet, Orphée la différence. Et tout récemment, Le triomphe de l'amour, traduction encore une fois du très fidèle René Gallet, publié par Chêne, C-H-E-Y-N-E. Et je vous rappelle ou je vous signale que M. Hill signera ce livre à la librairie Compagnie, qui se trouve, comme vous le savez sans doute, dans la rue des Écoles, tout près, juste en face de la Sorbonne. Monsieur Hill a reçu, évidemment, beaucoup d'honneurs, beaucoup de distinctions. Il est Honorary Fellow du Collège d'Oxford, où il a fait ses études, Honorary Fellow du Collège de Cambridge, où il a enseigné. Il a reçu une série impressionnante de prix, parmi les plus importants. On organise des colloques autour de son œuvre, on écrit des livres sur ses poèmes, mais tout cela sans être inimportant, comme on devrait pouvoir le dire en français, n'a pas beaucoup d'importance devant le seul critère qui compte vraiment, qui est la très grande excellence de sa poésie. Sa poésie s'est imposée lentement mais sûrement comme une des poésies les plus fortes de notre époque et aussi une des plus belles, comme une poésie qui permet de donner à l'idée de beauté un sens profond, large et complexe. Je l'ai découvert lors de la publication de son 3e volume. On ne peut pas tout lire et je n'avais pas noté la parution des 2 premiers. Le 3e volume qui est Mercian Hymns, Hymne de merci, publié en 1971. Et mon attention était aussitôt acquise. C'est un livre où, parmi beaucoup d'autres choses, il met en relation l'anglais moderne et l'anglais spécifiquement des saxons, mais des anglo-saxons aussi, le vieil anglais, ce qui crée un lien un peu curieux et tout à fait fortuit avec ma propre lecture de poèmes de samedi dernier. Il est en effet un des poètes, peut-être le poète anglais, qui a le mieux su sonder les ressources historiques multiples de l'anglais et de la poésie anglaise, à une époque où une sorte d'anglais international abâtardi menace l'anglais des anglophones. Il a voué son œuvre à la recherche de responsible speech, d'une parole responsable devant surtout les violences et les démissions de l'histoire, et également devant l'indignation facile et au fond satisfaite de soi que provoquent le plus souvent ces violences et ces démissions. On apprend avec Geoffrey Hill qu'un poème est un acte et qu'il doit répondre aux mêmes exigences et aux mêmes critères moraux, spirituels que tous nos autres actes. Avec le sérieux de son projet et la nature de ses préoccupations, il aurait pu écrire une poésie lourde et mélancolique, mais on remarque une forte dose d'humour, c'est un anglais, de comédie, la recherche de choses positives, de ce qui ouvre plutôt que de fermer, et même la recherche d'une joie sévère, difficile, et qu'il faut mériter. Et ce sont la joie et aussi l'admiration et l'amour de l'éloge. Il a dit dans un entretien, j'aime louer, j'aime admirer. Ce sont la joie, l'admiration, la louange qui sous-tendent et qui rendent possible, peut-on penser, la dose de satire, de parodie et de tragicomédie que sa poésie met très souvent en œuvre. Je lui passe la parole maintenant. Over to you, Jeffrey.
Monsieur le professeur Edwards, mesdames, messieurs, the title of my lecture, as you have it in the foyer, is a species of bêtise ou sottise. I was ashamed to appear before you in so venerable a place of learning with only my poems to offer. I put together, concocted rather desperately, a pseudo title and a nugatory topic. I was scarcely at the beginning of my notes when I realized that I had not the slightest interest in contemporary British poetry or British philosophy. And I thought that it might be more amusing for you if I spoke a little about my indebtedness to the poets and prose writers of France. When the war began, I mean, of course, la Deuxième Guerre mondiale, I was 7 years old. And when it finished, I was in my 13th year. Now, politically, relations between our two countries were not good after Dunkirk. May culturally, there remained much sympathy, particularly with any literature that could be gathered into the net named Résistance. Et pour moi, j'étais un gaulliste de 7 ans. The London-based magazine Horizon, under the editor Cyril Connolly, was especially pro-French and published the work of Aragon, among others. And in prose writing, the name of Vercors comes to me over the years. I was a little too young to concern myself with these writings when they originally appeared in the years 1941, 42, 44, But by the time of my 15th birthday, I was a passionately committed poet, a jeune homme de lettres. And back copies of Horizon were still easily available for me to read. T.S. Eliot bestowed his considerable literary prestige and patronage on two French writers during those years, especially Saint-Jean Perse and Simone Weil. I can say with some confidence that I was acquainted with the work of Simone Weil by the early 1950s, while I was still an étudiant dans l'Université d'Oxford. I mean particulièrement two of her books, L'Enracinement et Attente de Dieu, though I knew them only in their English translations. And I have returned to Simone Weil at intervals throughout the subsequent decades. As I now recall, and you must remember I am nearly 80 years old, as I now recall, the 1960s was the period of my first phase of engagement with European literature in general. Par exemple, I tried to teach myself Spanish in order to read Miguel Hernandez, also the Baroque 17th century poets, for example, Góngora, who had influenced him. And I was also making the acquaintance of your poets in French by way of the Poète d'aujourd'hui in Les Éditions Pierre Segers. And I was particularly impressed by the writings of Robert Desnos, and haunted by one of his lines. I am remembering this line after some 50 years, and I have not rechecked my text. Pardon me if it is not exact, but I recall it as being most êtes-vous des mythes et pareil aux myrtes des morts? Mos êtes-vous des mythes et pareil aux myrtes des morts? What impressed me was the powerful self-containment of such a line. It did not seem to require anything outside itself by way of narrative or common opinion. B, it nonetheless contained within itself the powerful residues of a cultural situation in which the poem était une isolée, isolated in a desert of rapidly shifting opinion. C, it refashioned traditional symbolic values, meat, mirt, mar, into a rhetoric that I instantly recognized as being of my time. Day, it pointed the way towards a reconciliation of metaphysics, symbolism, and the sensuous. A reconciliation, or attempted reconciliation, which I dare to say has been one of the major preoccupations of my own work during the past 30, 40 years. A preoccupation which has grown all the more intense the older I have become. There are two statements of Simone Weil to which I have returned more than once in lectures and essays over the past 40 or so years, most recently in lectures delivered at the University of Cambridge in 2005. The first is from Attente de Dieu and is in the form of a spiritual autobiography written in May 1942, in which she contrasts her own achievements with those of her gifted mathematician brother. Il faut que vous me pardonniez. C'est drôle. C'est trop drôle. Je présente aux auditeurs français un livre français, mais en anglais. C'est stupide. And you must forgive me that I read this magnificent French writer en anglais. She says, I did not mind having no visible successes, but what did grieve me was the idea of being excluded from that transcendent kingdom to which only the truly great have access, and wherein truth abides. And the second, which is perhaps the more far-reaching in its implications, is from L'Enracinement, and reads as follows, hélas, en anglais, simultaneous composition on several planes at once is the law of artistic creation, and wherein, in fact, lies its difficulty. A poet in the arrangement of words and the choice of each word must simultaneously bear in mind matters on at least five or six different planes of composition. Politics, in their turn, form an art governed by composition on a multiple plane. I cannot think of any statement by any 20th century writer, whether French, Italian, Spanish, German, or English, which has influenced my writing or thinking more profoundly than has the second of those two quotations from Simone Weil. I propose now to pause for a while from discourse and to read one or two of my poems, poems even so to which I believe what I have just said concerning desnus and vai serves as a necessary preamble. Four poems regarding the endurance of poets. Numero 1, Men are a mockery of angels. In memoriam, Tommaso Campanella, priest and poet. Some days a shadow through the high window shares my prison. I watch a slug scale the glinting pit side of its own slime. The cries as they come are mine, then God's. My justice wounds love, derisive light, bread, filth. To lie here in my strange flesh, while glutted torment sleeps, stained with its prompt food, is a joy past all care of the world for a time. But we are commanded to rise when in silence I would compose my voice. Numero 2, A Prayer to the Sun, in memoriam Miguel Hernandez. Darkness above all things the sun makes rise. Vultures salute their meat at noon. Hell is silent. Blind sun, our ravager, bless us so that we sleep. Numero 3, Domaine Public, in memoriam Robert Desnos, died Terezin Camp, 1945. For reading, I can recommend the fathers, how they cultivate the corrupting flesh. Toothsome contemplation, cleanly maggots churning spleen to milk. For exercise, prolonged suppression of much improper speech from proper tombs. If the ground opens, should men's mouths open also? I am nothing if not saved now. Or, Christ, what a pantomime! The days of the week are seven pits. Look, Seigneur, again we resurrect, and the judges come. Numero 4, Tristia, a valediction to Josef Mandelstam. Difficult friend, I would have preferred you to them. The dead keep their sealed lives, and again I am too late. Too late the salutes, dust clouds, and brazen cries. Images rear from desolation like ruins upon a plain. A few men glare at their hands. Others grovel for food in the roadside field. Tragedy has all under regard. It will not touch us, but it is there. Flawless, insatiate, hard summer sky feasting on this, reaching its own end. You will not be astonished to hear that I believe it is inevitable that any serious poetry written at the present time will be inextricably caught up in politics. I do not mean that it has to be a naive vehicle for the transmission of political opinions and sentiments, as Aragon's was for the conveyance of communist platitudes, and as for a time, before he became a truly great poet, as for a time, the poetry of Paul Éluard was a vehicle for the transmission de platitude. The Irish writer, Conall Cruise O'Brien, who in the 1960s achieved high office in the United Nations and was actively involved in the Katanga troubles in the 1960s, wrote under a pseudonym a book called Maria Cross, un caractère de François Mauriac. This book, Maria Cross, by Conall Cruise O'Brien, was in the main an attack on right-wing French writers of the first half of the 20th century. And it may have been in this book, by O'Brien, that I encountered in the late 1950s the name of Charles Péguy. It is many years since I read O'Brien's book, and I do not want to misrepresent his views. But as I recall, Péguy appears in his pages as a kind of crypto-fascist Catholic. Those who take this view base it largely on the evidence of Péguy's violently expressed opposition to the peace initiations of the socialist Jean Jaurès in the opening days of La Grande Guerre. But to take this view requires one to overlook the fact that Péguy was a fervent Dreyfusard and a passionate philosémite. I cannot see how he could be seriously aligned with such right-wing activists as Barrès and Mora. The mystery of the charity of Charles Péguy, part one. Crack of a starting pistol, Jean Jaurès dies in a wine puddle. Who or what stares through the cafe window, creped in powder smoke? The bill for the new farce reads, Sleepers Awake. History commands the stage, wielding a toy gun, rehearsing another scene. It has raged so before countless times, and will do countless times more, in the guise of a supreme clown, dire tragedian. In Brutus' name, martyr and mountebank, ghost Caesar's ghost, his wounds of air and ink painlessly spouting. Jaurès' blood lies stiff on menu card, shirt front, and handkerchief. Did Péguy kill Jaurès? Did he incite the assassin? Must men stand by what they write, as by their camp beds or their weaponry, or shell-shocked comrades while they sag and cry? Would Péguy answer, stubbornly on guard among the cahiers, with his army cape and steely pince-nez and his hermit's beard, brooding on conscience and embattled hope? truth's pedagogue, braving an entrenched class of fools and scoundrels, children of the world, his eyes caged and hostile behind glass. Still, Peggy said that hope is a little child. Violent contrariety of men and days, calm, juddery bombardment of a silent film showing such things, its canvas slashed with rain and St. Elmo's fire, victory of the machine. The brisk celluloid clatters through the gate. The cortege of the century dances in the street, and over, the jolly cartoon armies of France go reeling towards Verdun. Peggy was a complex man, I believe a good and decent man. I would describe him as I would describe moi-même, as an hierarchical democrat. And as I would describe Simone Weil as an hierarchical democrat. I am thinking of such a book as Peggy's L'Argent and the concluding pages of Weil's L'Enracinement. And outside France, I am thinking of the program for a post-war Germany, drawn up in secret meetings by members of the so-called Kreisauer Kreis, the Kreisau circle of the German Widerstand, or resistance, most of whom were tortured and executed after the failure of the Juillet 20th bomb plot in 1944. I am here thinking rather of Helmut James Graf von Moltke and of the jurist Hans Bernd von Haften rather than of von Stauffenberg, who had been a youthful member of the Circle of Neophytes, Cercle de Neophytes, the Georg Kreis, the somewhat shrill admirers of the poet Stefan George. Here is the beginning of my elegy for Hans Bernd von Haften. The sequence is called De Jure Belli Ac Pacis. The title of a book by the jurist Grotius. The people moves as one spirit unfettered, claim our assessors of stone. When the nations fall dispossessed, such conjurings possess them. Elaborate barren fountains, projected aqueducts, where water is no longer found. Where would one find Grotius, for that matter, the secular justice clamant among psalms, huge-fisted, visionary Comenius? Could none predict these haughty degradations as now your high-strung, martyred resistance serves to consecrate the liberties of Maastricht? When speaking in a nation other than one's own, I think one must observe a basic code of etiquette and refrain from criticizing the current politics of one's hosts. So let us leave current French politics quite out of the discussion and refer merely to a broad pan-European or indeed global spectrum, including my own nation, the United Kingdom. During the past year, Things have been happening in the domain of finance, yet again, as they happened in 1929 and 1930, that make it seem to our view, hierarchical democrat comme moi-même, as the merest congerie of business convenience, that a true description of the situation européenne might be plutocratic anarchy. A further poem about Angleterre, Grande-Bretagne, seen as in sort the plutocratic anarchy, to the High Court of Parliament, November 1994, who could outbalance poised Marvel, balk the strength of Gilray's unrelenting, unreconciling mind, grandees riven from scavenge, to whom Milton addressed his ideal censure. Once more singular, ill-attended, staid and bitter commedia, as she is called, delivers to your mirth her veiled presence. Nonetheless amazing, Barry's and Pugin's grand dark lantern above the incumbent Thames, you as by custom unillumined masters of servile counsel. Who can now speak for despoiled merit, the fouled catchments of Demos, as thy high lamp presides with sovereign equity over against us, across this densely reflective, long-drawn procession of waters. The title of that poem echoes the opening words of John Milton's great prose tract, Areopagitica, for the liberty of unlicensed printing. It first appeared in November 1644. So November 1994 marked the 350th anniversary of its appearance. Marvel is Andrew Marvel, the parliamentarian and friend of Milton. Gilray is a savage 18th century political satirist. Barry and Pugin are the architect and the interior designer of the present Houses of Parliament in Londres, which were built around the middle of the 19th century. With that brief explication, perhaps I should now read the poem again. To the High Court of Parliament, November 1994. Who could outbalance poised Marvel, balk the strength of Gilray's unrelenting, unreconciling mind, grandees arisen from scavenge, to whom Milton addressed his ideal censure? Once more singular, ill-attended, staid and bitter commedia, as she is called, delivers to your mirth her veiled presence. Nonetheless amazing, Barry's and Pugin's grand dark lantern above the incumbent Thames, you as by custom unillumined masters of servile counsel, who can now speak for despoiled merit the fouled catchments of Demos, as thy high lamp presides with sovereign equity over against us, across this densely reflective, long-drawn procession of waters. Hostile critics of mine in the UK and the USR, on the evidence of this poem, The Fouled Catchments of Demos, accuse me of being an anti-democrat. And when The Mystery of the Charity of Charles Péguy appeared in print in 1983, somebody described me in a review as a chthonic nationalist, which I understand is a legal alternative to calling me a crypto-fascist. And when the American edition of my most recent recueil, A Treatise of Civil Power, appeared a few weeks ago, the reviewer in the New York Times Book Review, January the 20th, 2008, wrote, Hill has made brutally plain that the common reader is of no interest to him. Indeed, he believes that sinking to common ground betrays the high purpose of verse. With a withering pride, he has refused time and again to stoop to such betrayals. Now, this is a plain libel, and I can refute it directly. On page 459 of the newly published volume, Geoffrey Hill, Collected Critical Writings, we find the following sentence. The true common reader is a natural aristocrat of the spirit and is far more necessary, far more valuable to a culture such as ours than are the majority of its writers. The true common reader is a natural aristocrat of the spirit and is far more necessary, far more valuable to a culture such as ours than are the majority of its writers. And this is by the anti-democrat, Geoffrey Hill, the crypto-fascist. A few years ago, the distinguished British jurist David Windlesham paid my work a great compliment. He entitled volume 4 of his series, Responses to Crime, Dispensing Justice. He took this title from one line of my poem, The Mystery of the Charity of Charles Péguy. The line reads as follows. To dispense, virgule, with justice, point virgule, or virgule, to dispense with justice. Ce vers n'est pas un jeu de mots, c'est un jeu de syntaxe. En anglais, to dispense, virgule, with justice, signifie to behave justly, signifie qu'on se comporte ou se conduit envers toutes les personnes avec la justice. Alors, en anglais, to dispense, pas virgule, with justice, signifie tout le contraire, exactement le contraire. Alors, David Windlesham placed two epigraphs at the beginning of his book. L'un, c'est mon vers. L'autre, c'est une phrase d'attorney general anglais. En anglais, to dispense justice fairly and efficiently and to promote confidence in the rule of law. Clearly, plainly, il est évident que David Windlesham regards the words of the Attorney General anglais as une espèce de persiflage, comme nous disons en anglais spin, le spin. David Windlesham says in his preface, the subtitle of his volume, Dispensing Justice, derives from, découle de, the two epigraphs. In giving, this is encore David Windlesham qui parle, in giving permission to reprint the brief but telling extract from The Mystery of the Charity of Charles Peguy, Geoffrey Hill remarked, as I did in correspondence, Geoffrey Hill remarked that such a use confirmed his belief that poetry is an art of public significance. Windlesham continued, the contrast is apt between Hill's precise use of words and punctuation and the overarching aims of the ministerial mission statement. Je m'en tiens à mon expression, poetry is an art of public significance, while at the same time I recognize that poetry has no public. Poetry has no public. La poésie ne possède pas ni un statut professionnel ni un signe de prestige dans le domaine public. In one sense, my words quoted by David Windlesham are much too optimistic. Or let us be cheerful. As Nadia Boulanger used to say en anglais, permit me to laugh a little. Let us be cheerful and say that I am a despairing optimist. Maintenant, un autre poème de mon nouveau recueil, A Treatise of Civil Power. On looking through 50 Jahre im Bild, Bundesrepublik Deutschland. It is not a matter of justice. Justice is in another world, or of injustice even. That is beside the point, or almost. Nor even of the continuity of hirelings, the resourceful, those who are obese, the excellent heads of hair, the beautiful or plain wives, secretaries and translators, the riots and demonstrations that now appear like interludes, masks or pageants or students' rags, the police water cannon. You look for the film's director but cannot find him. There is the captioned wall. There the Reichstag, the Brandenburger Tor, variously refurbished, with and without wire. There's Willy Brandt, kneeling at the ghetto memorial on his visit to Warsaw, December of 1970. I did what people do when words fail them. mon titre, en looking through en parcourant finzige Jahre im Bild Bundesrepublik Deutschland. C'est une espèce de beau livre qui nous appelons en Angleterre coffee table book. The point of the poem is in the final line, which repeats exactly en anglais what Willy Brandt said en allemand, bien sûr que oui, when asked why he had knelt in front of the ghetto memorial in Warsaw. It is one of the great photographic images of the 20th century that the state, on a state visit to Warsaw, Brandt fell to his knees. The Chancellor of Deutschland fell to his knees in front of the memorial in the ghetto. And when asked why he had done this, he said, je traduis en anglais, I did what people do when words fail them. Having explained that, let me read it again. On looking through 50 Jahre im Bild Bundesrepublik Deutschland, it is not a matter of justice. Justice is in another world, or of injustice even. That is beside the point, or almost. Nor even of the continuity of hirelings, the resourceful, those who are obese, the excellent heads of hair, the beautiful or plain wives, secretaries and translators, the riots and demonstrations that now appear like interludes, masks or pageants or students' rags, the police water cannon. You look for the film's director, but cannot find him. There is the captioned wall. There the Reichstag, the Brandenburger Tor, variously refurbished, with and without wire. There's Willy Brandt, kneeling at the ghetto memorial on his visit to Warsaw, December of 1970. I did what people do when words fail them. As I said, it is one of the great images, photographic images of the 20th century. For a poet, the incident is also a powerful oxymoron. An oxymoron rather than a paradox, I think. In affirming the helplessness of words, it simultaneously affirms the integrity of words. It is a matter of intrinsic value. La valeur intrinsique, c'est un concept essentiel et une qualité essentielle de John Ruskin. Une phrase de quoi mes idées pour la plupart déroulent. This phrase de John Ruskin. Une phrase de quoi mes idées pour la plupart déroulent. I refer anyone interested in following through my suggestion to the following pages in the recently published collected critical writings of Geoffrey Hill, Oxford University Press, 2008, page 12, 16, oh non, en anglais. Les numéros français, mais défait. pages 12, 16, 228, 251, 363, 383, 388 to 90, 404, 464, 465 to 489, 530. For instance, from John Ruskin, "Everything costs its own cost, and one of our best virtues is a just desire to pay it." Or another, "It does not in the least affect the intrinsic value of the wheat, blé, wheat, blé, yeah, the air or the flowers, that men refuse or despise them. Used or not, their own power is in them, and that particular power is in nothing else." In my immediate practice as a poet, as well as in my critical writings about public language, I have tried to transform the sense of intrinsic value into matters of semantic pitch. Now, we have a difficulty. In French, your word for pitch is ton, a fact which is regrettable from the point of view of my argument, since I claim that pitch and tone are distinct entities. Pitch, pour moi, is the way words interact with each other in a poem. Tone is the value imposed on words by various forms of cultural pressure. I think that in French, to understand my sense of pitch, you would need to think of certain instruments. Par exemple, le diapason à branche, le diapason à bouche, le diapason électronique, pitch-giving instruments. When I said earlier in my commentary that Simone Weil had influenced me profoundly, I think I meant it in the sense that reading her confirmed for me certain matters that I had already known and experienced intuitively. For example, two quotations en anglais. To watch a good, loved as such, condemned as it were by the oncoming tide of events, is an intolerable suffering. B. Our period has destroyed the interior hierarchy. How should it allow the social hierarchy, which is only a clumsy image of it, to go on existing? It seems to me now somewhat strange that I have never dedicated a poem to the memory of Simone Weil. Permit me to do so with this commentary and this reading of two poems with which I will conclude this occasion. Broken hierarchies. When to depict rain, heavy rain, it stands in dense verticals, diagonally lashed, chalk white, yet with the chalk translucent. The roadway sprouts a thousand flowerets, storm paddies instantly reaped, replenished, and again cut down. The holding burden of a wisteria drape amid drape, the sodden copia of all things flashing and drying. First here after the storm, these butterflies fixed on each jinking run, probing, priming, then leaping back. A babble of silent tongues, and the flint church also choiring into dazzle. Like Appalachian music, those aureate stark sounds, plucked or bowed, a wild patience replete with loss, the twankled dulcimer, scrawny, rich fiddle gnawing, a man's low voice that looms out of the drone, the hummingbird that is not of these climes, and the great wanderers like the albatross, the ocean ranging in, laying itself down on our alien shore. And to conclude, one of my very few efforts à traduire. My translation, ou imitation, peut-être, poème de Eugenio Montale, La Bufera, The Storm. I read this at the British Institute in Firenze last year, and when I had finished, an old gentleman, may not as old as I am, said, "Signor, your translation is nearly as good as the original." And I was immensely honored and said so. The Storm, after Eugenio Montale, La Bufera. The storm that batters the magnolia's impermeable leaves, the long-drawn drum roll of Martian thunder with its hail. Crystal acoustics trembling in your night's lair disturb you, while the gold transfumed from the mahoganies, the pages rims of deluxe books, still burns a sugar grain under your eyelid shell. Lightning that makes stark white the trees, the walls, suspending them, interminable instant, marbled manner and cataclysm, deep in you sculpted, born now as condemnation. This binds you closer to me, strange sister, than any love. So the harsh buskings, bashing of castanets and tambourines around the spoiler's ditch, fandango's foot rap, and over all some gestures still to be defined, as when you turned away and casting with a hand that cloudy mass of hair from off your forehead, gave me a sign and stepped into the dark. Mesdames et messieurs, je vous remercie beaucoup pour votre patience héroïque et stoïque. Merci.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.